Well, as you can see, we're going to be talking about being a friend of Jesus. And I want to begin by turning over to John chapter 15. I want us to understand that while we're going to be talking about Abraham, we don't ever want to begin to think that while these are very special people to us because we have the record of their life, their ups and their downs, that somehow you can't be a friend of God. And yet Jesus said, and there's a good way to remember this, in John 14, 15, if you love me, keep my commandments. John 14, 15. Flip that around. John 15, 14 reads, no longer do I call you servants, for a servant does not know his master, does not know what his master is doing, but I have called you friends, for all things that I've heard from my Father I've made known to you. You did not choose me, but I choose you and appointed you that you should go and bear fruit, that your fruit should remain, that if whatever you ask the Father in my name, he will give you. These things I command you, that you love one another. In verse 14, you are my friends if you do whatever I command you. So we can be a friend of God too by doing the things that are commanded. And Jesus, again, there's a close connection with him and the relationship with him, verse 15, 16, and 17. But in verse 14, we are friends if we'll do whatever Jesus commands us to do. So we'll talk about Abraham, but again, our approach has been a little bit different in that we're not going to necessarily talk about the things that we might normally, I'm thinking of his sacrifice of Isaac. Let's look at a few other things about Abraham that'll be a benefit to us. After Noah woke up from being drunk, you remember that he cursed his youngest son, Ham. And by cursing his son, Canaan, and so Ham's son, Canaan, is cursed into servitude of his brother. That's in Genesis chapter 9 and in verse 26. And then we learn that Noah blessed Shem. And you remember we talked about Shem, Ham, and Japheth, that Japheth is the oldest, Ham the youngest, and in the middle was Shem. And that Shem was the one that actually got the blessing. And it is, in fact, the blessing in Genesis 9 and in the next verse 27, that it is that Canaan would be his servant. So just like we see in the Jacob and Esau and how Jacob served the older Esau, we see here that God made the Messiah come through Shem and that he had blessed him. In chapter 11 of Genesis, it's when you just kind of look at your headings there, you'll recall that in chapter 11, this is when the people gathered together and decided they wanted to make a name for themselves, and they built a tower, the story that we call the Tower of Babel. But it's at that time that God does not approve of this, and so what he does is this is where he has the different languages that come about. And so now everybody's speaking a different language, and they can't communicate, and then therefore he scatters them, and so now everybody's been scattered. And you remember, the command was to go forth into the world and to multiply, become fruitful and multiply. And so what they've done is they've kind of gathered, and now they're building this tower into heaven. And so God says, I don't approve of that, so that's what he did. Now in chapter 11, verse 10 to 32, if you're kind of looking there, you'll see that it says Shem's descendants. So we've got a genealogy here that's taking place. But I want to notice of interest, look at verse 27. This is the genealogy of Terah. Terah begot Abram, Nahor, and Haran begat Lot. And Haran died before his father Terah in his native land in Ur of the Chaldees. Then Abraham and Nahor took wives. The name of Abraham's wife was Sarai, and the name of Nahor's wife was Milcah, the daughter of Haran, the father of Milcah, and of the father Iscah. But Sarah was barren and she had no child. And Terah took his son Abram and his grandson Lot, the son of Haran, and his daughter-in-law Sarah and his son Abram's wife. And they went out with them from Ur of Chaldees to the land of Canaan, and they came to Haran and dwelt there. So the days of Terah were 205 years, and then Terah died in Haran. So, and this is, you know, specific to us because this is who we're going to be talking about is Abraham. So what we learn here is that when Abraham left, and he left with Sarah and his father, and also his brother Haran's son Lot, because Haran had died, and so now he's under the care of his grandfather and Abraham, and so this is where we learn about Lot. I wanted to show you a few pictures, and the reason for this is there's going to be a few. This is the tell of, and I can't pronounce this, M-U-Q-A-Y-Y-A-R, but it's the Ur of Chaldees. And so this is the area that Abraham came out of, and I wanted you to show this to you because there's a number of pictures. This site was chiefly excavated by Sir Leonard Woolley between 1922 and 1934. And if you go and do any searching on this, you're going to see there's so much with regards to this. In fact, there's some documentaries that you can kind of watch about this. This was huge because second to King Tut's tomb being found, this was huge. And this is in Ur of Chaldees. So this is what I want you to begin is to understand where Abraham came from. And so this is excavation here that they did. Some of these came in conjunction with the University of Pennsylvania. And so there's some different museums that house these different things and they get passed around. But the University of Pennsylvania was huge back in 1922 when this happened with Sir Leonard. And so you've got all these people excavating. And they uncovered this right here, this ziggurat, and it's kind of like, it's not a pyramid, but it's got these steps that just go up to it. And they started uncovering this thing. And not only did they uncover it, but they actually took and you can, I should have put a background behind this. This ziggurat stands as an emblematic structure of the ancient Mesopotamian world, a testament to humanity's architectural and religious aspirations. With its massive size and an intricate design, these stepped pyramids not only functioned as religious centers, but also epitomized the might and splendor of the civilization that built them. And so this is like a pyramid, but this, you know, looks like to be in great shape. Well, that's because not only did they, you know, do the archaeological dig, but they actually have renovated it or made it, restored it. They've spent the time to make sure that it stands. And so you could go over there and see that today. This picture that's coming up is actually of Haran. But I wanted you to know that back here, the big discovery was, and again, this is attributed to Sir Leonard Woolley, the archaeologist. I hope I'm not saying architect instead of archaeologist. But anyway, they found 1,850 tombs, and it's become known as like this royal cemetery because there are 16 of those tombs that became very, very important because of the things that they find. Let me see here. So this is a picture of an example of like the royal type tombs that they found. But I've got, let me see. Yeah, so here is, this they found in Queen, and I don't know how you pronounce that either. This is her headdress. This was found in her tomb. And like I said, you could go if you want to spend some time, you can look and watch some documentaries and things about this of when what they discovered and what they think they found. But it was interesting because in the tomb itself, there's all these dead bodies. And so they think that what happened was that when she died and there in the tomb, they actually had some type of ceremony and drank poison or something, and they all died around there. And there's a cart with oxen, and it's just amazing all the things that they found. But the wealth that was there, and so here's a couple of things. That was found there. Look at that. That's a gold tumbler. And so it also showed that there was the ability, they can tell you what it's made out of, gold and silver alloy, and the techniques and the things that they could do. And then here you have, this is her headdress that was taken, and that's at the University of Pennsylvania, and again, it'll be moved. Actually, it found it, you know, some of these, they got so much stuff that they just, it's on in storage right now instead of like being on display. So that type of thing goes on too. But here's a picture of the headdress kind of thing and what they suspect it looked like because of how they found, you know, as the strings that held the beads or whatever fell, then they're laying there. And so they kind of reconstruct these things. But the headdress, again, when everything that held it together, you've got the, you know, it's just laying there. So you just kind of put it back together. But anyway, this was huge because, as I said, it was like second to finding King Tut's tomb at the time. And so the point of my showing you all this is not to just say, oh, wow, this is the area that Abraham left. It was a thriving population of the ancient world. This is in what we would call the cradle of civilization, where they believe, of course, the Garden of Eden was. Abraham and Adam and Eve were cast out of the garden, and then, you know, and then God makes them scatter. So it's like this is like the cradle of civilization down in here. And God called him out of this flourishing part of the world to a land of promise. And so this is where you've grown up. This is where, you know, life has been. And then God calls you and takes you out of that land into a territory you don't know where you're going. Look at just a couple of passages. Look at Nehemiah chapter 9. Nehemiah. And let me see if I've got my passages up here yet. Here's the map that kind of shows what I was talking about. Here's Ur. And, of course, we don't know, but the Garden of Eden is thought to be, you know, it's described as the different rivers and so forth. But you can see this area right here is called the cradle of civilization, to where everything spread from that. Nehemiah chapter 9, let me get there. And in verse 7, so you find that this is late in Israel's history. You remember they've been in captivity, they've come back, they're building the walls, the temple. So this is late in the history of Israel. This is just to show you about Abraham and how it was always known. You are the Lord who chose Abram, brought him out of the Ur of the Chaldeans, and gave him the name Abraham. So this is something that they have known. This is why by the time Jesus comes, you got Father Abraham, Isaac, Jacob. This was just who was associated with when God called Abraham out of the Ur of Chaldees. And when Stephen gave his history lesson in Acts chapter 7, notice what he says about this in verse 2 through 4. And I've made the point before, but it's good for us to kind of have that big picture of the Bible being one story. You should be able to start with Adam and Eve and talk about some things and move right on into Noah and then move to Abraham and into Moses. You know, it's a complete story. And so you can see these things like Stephen does. This is quite a history lesson. He knew his history of the people. Verse 2 through 4, he said, "Brethren and fathers, listen, the God of glory appeared to our father Abraham when he was in Mesopotamia before he dwelt in Haran. And he said to him, 'Get out of your country from your relatives and come to a land that I will show you.' And then he came out of the land of the Chaldeans and dwelt in Haran. And from there, when his father was dead, he moved him to this land in which you now dwell." So it goes, he knew that God had called him. Now this is where they move. This is just in Genesis chapter 12. And verse 1 through 3, this is the first promise where we find him promising a nation and a land and then the seed promise. "Now the Lord said to Abram, 'Get out of your country,'" verse 1, "'from your family and from your father's house to a land that I will show you, and I will make you a great nation, and I will bless you and make your name great. And you shall be a blessing, and I will bless those who bless you, and I'll curse him who curses you. And in you all the families of the earth shall be blessed.'" So this is from Bible Places. I've mentioned that this is a great place to get pictures. A lot of them you have access to. Some of them you don't have an access to them. But this is one that we had access to. And this is the excavation of ancient Haran. So this is when we come back to our map. So they left the Ur of Chaldees, and look where they came. They came way up here, and then his father died. But he is called out of the Ur of Chaldees, and he comes up to Haran. And so our lesson is titled A Friend of God. And we begin to see that in verse 4, because in verse 4 of chapter 12 it says, "So Abram departed as the Lord had spoken to him, and Lot with him. And Abram was 75 years old when he departed from Haran." So he's 75 years old when he begins this quest down into the promised land. And you know that he always dwelt in tents. He was a pilgrim. He was a stranger. But he did this at the age of 75. And that would be equivalent to calling some of you who have been, this has been your home. This has been where you dwelt. Now again, he's come out of the Ur of Chaldees. He spent some time in Haran. But God called him out of the place that he was so familiar with. And it'd be like one of us being called and being told, "I want you to leave everybody and everything that you know, and I want you to go, and I want you to take off, and you don't even know where you're going." And of course, we see that that's what Abram did. And then in Hebrews chapter 11 and in verse 8, "By faith, Abraham obeyed when he was called to go out to the place which he would receive as an inheritance, and he went out not knowing where he was going." So he did all that by faith. And that's what we talk about so often is when we think about Abraham, we talk about the faith of Abraham. Well, in verse 5 of Genesis chapter 12, "Then Abram took Sarah his wife and Lot and his brother's son and all their possessions that they had gathered, and the people whom they had acquired in Haran, and they departed to go to the land of Canaan." So they came to the land of Canaan. What you see here is that he's accumulated a great bit of wealth, because it's seen in his possessions that he takes, but he has these household servants that it says that he has acquired. And so we understand that he is someone that is, we're going to kind of see that everything is kind of growing for Abraham. But one of the first things that happens is, and we know this, is that Abraham gets ahead of God. And in, this is in chapter, let me change my notes here. This is still in chapter 12, there, verses 10 to 20. So there's a famine in the land. And it is a severe and it is a great famine. And this is one of the times that Abraham gets ahead of himself. And there are times that we get ahead of ourselves. But as they make their way to Egypt, and isn't that interesting that where would he go when there's a famine? Well, let's think of Joseph and him being in Egypt and his brothers making that journey. So he's going down to Egypt, but as they're getting close to the to Egypt, this is when he realizes, I've got a beautiful wife. And he comes up with a plan. And his plan is, you tell them that you're my sister, because if they know you're my wife, they're going to kill me. And so he comes up with a plan to save his own life. And she says, you tell them that you're my sister, and they won't kill him. Well, sure enough, when they arrive there in Egypt, as you're kind of skimming over that, verses 10 to 20, you recall that the Egyptian princess, she caught their eye. And she's then commended to Pharaoh himself. And what we find in verse 16, he treated Abram well for her sake. He had sheep and oxen and male donkeys and male and female servants and female donkeys and camels. But the Lord plagued Pharaoh and his house with a great plagues because of Sarai, Abram's wife. And Pharaoh called Abram and said, what is it that you've done to me? Why did you not tell me that she was your wife? Why did you say she's my sister? I might have taken her as my wife. Now therefore, here's your wife. Take her and go your way. So Pharaoh commanded his men concerning him, and they sent him away and his wife and all that he had. So again, this is one of those situations where Abraham is kind of getting ahead of himself and ahead of God. And instead of trusting in God, he comes up with the plan. And it did not go well for Pharaoh. But notice there in the end of chapter 12 into 13. Then Abram went up from Egypt, he and his wife and all that he had, and Lot with him to the south. Abram was very rich in livestock, in silver, and in gold. So now he's become very wealthy. He's got great possessions. He's got silver, he's got gold. So God is blessing him. God is blessing him. And while Abraham is lacking trust in God, God is still turning things to Abraham's favor. And so we see God always moving his plan forward. And that's one of the things that I want you to see, that even though Abraham is not a perfect man, and though he has great faith and he's identified as a friend of God, God still moves his plan forward when these people are not exactly going in the direction they need to go. Now, when you come to chapter 13, and we learn just how wealthy Abraham is, we also see that he is someone that sought for a very peaceful solution. And so this is something that's very important for Abraham. And you'll see the text calls him Abram, but I'm going to call him Abraham most of the time. But if you're looking at verse 5 to 7, Lot also, who went with Abram, had flocks and herds and tents. Now the land was not able to support them that they might dwell together, for their possessions were so great that they could not dwell together. And there was strife between the herdsmen of Abraham's livestock and the herdsmen of Lot's livestock, and the Canaanites and the Perizzites that dwelt in the land. So you've got all of this, you know, there's not enough land. You can just see them jockeying for it, and it's causing all kinds of problems and difficulties. Now, what do you know about Abraham? Well, Abraham's the patriarch. So who, and I think most of you understand the term Trump, having the Trump card. Who do you think had the Trump card here, Abraham or Lot, his nephew? Well, Abraham being the patriarch of the family, you know good and well he could have said, Lot, you go over there. I'm going to take this land. But that's not what he did. That's not what he did. And you see in Abraham a very kind and loving man who thought so much about the well-being of his family. You can't help but see how much he thought about somebody else instead of himself. Because he says in verse 9, is not the whole land before you? Please separate from me. If you take the left, then I will go to the right. Or if you go to the right, then I'll go to the left. And Lot lifted his eyes and saw the plain of Jordan, and it was well watered everywhere before the Lord destroyed Sodom and Gomorrah. Now notice, like the garden of the Lord, like the land of Egypt as you go down towards Zoar. It was beautiful. It's like it's compared to like the Garden of Eden at the very beginning. It was just so here's the young one, and he's given, okay, you pick. And he goes, I want the best right over there. And Abraham said, if you'll go that direction, I'll go the other way. But you know, with Lot, that didn't turn out to be a good decision for him and his family. Because what you see in the text is he just, next thing you know, he's not just pitching close to Sodom, he's living in the city. He's living in the city. In verse 12, it says, Abraham dwelt in the land of Canaan, and Lot dwelt in the cities of the plain and pitched his tent even as far as Sodom. And that would cost him greatly. He loses a plurality of daughters and their husbands. His wife on the way out, and his daughters who would lie with him and give birth to to two nations, who would be the Moabites and the Ammonites, who were a constant thorn to the children of Israel. All because, again, of a decision right here is I want the best, and he couldn't handle it. And it ended up costing him dearly. And so he goes in rich, and he comes out poor. Now, this is a story about Abraham, and it reveals his might, and this is found in chapter 14. And sometimes I don't think we really think about Abraham being a mighty man and a warrior, but this story certainly would teach us that. I was even reading, and I couldn't find it where I had read this some time ago, but the Chaldeans, Ur of Chaldees, someone suggested that maybe he had gotten a lot of training there. And I want you to see that just how mighty of a man Abraham is. So what's going on in chapter 14 is you've got, we're going to say, five kings against four kings. This is the first record in the Bible of a war that breaks out. Five kings against four. Well, the four kings, they end up coming to the city of Sodom and Gomorrah, and those cities suffer defeat. And the cities are pillaged, And then the army leaves. But in verse 12, it says, and Abram dwelt, or in chapter 14, verse 12, they also took Lot, Abram's brother's son, who dwelt in Sodom, and his goods, and departed. And that's the verse that tells you, oh, wait a minute, where's he living? Now he's in the city. He was pitched near, but now he's actually in the city. Well, they take Lot. They take Lot and his goods, and they depart. Well, here's where we begin to learn that a man escapes, and he comes and he tells Abraham, they've taken your nephew Lot. A man who had escaped Dizon. Now, verse 13, the one who had escaped came and told Abram, the Hebrew, for he dwelt by the Terebinth tree of Mamre, the Amorite, brother of Eshcol, the brother of Aner, and they were allies with Abram. I want you to see that also. So something that Abraham has already done in the land is he's got allies. And that's important, isn't it? We do that, don't we have allies? Yeah, we've got people that if somebody comes at us, we've got allies. Well, he's got allies. So he learns that Lot's been taken. Let's look at verse 14. When Abram heard that his brother, and he calls him his brother, was taken captive, he armed his 318 trained servants who were born in his own house, and he went in pursuit as far as Dan. He divided his forces against them by night, and he and his servants attacked them and pursued them as far as Hobah, which is in the north of Damascus. So he went back. He brought back all the goods and also brought back his brother Lot and his goods, as well as the women and the people. And so where did these 318 trained men come from? That's an army. I mean, that's a good amount of people, but they're trained. Where did they get their training? You remember it says they were born in his house? And it even mentions that here. Well, there may be some indication, but Abraham is right there when they go into this situation. He is right there, and he goes in and is successful in getting his nephew back. Now, that's a very powerful move. That's a very bold move. It's a military campaign that's taken place, and he is successful at it, along, I think, with his allies. I think that's why they're mentioned as well. How could a man be so successful against four kings? Well, you know the answer, don't you? God had a plan, and he's moving that plan forward, as we see. Verse 19 and 20, we have Melchizedek, king of Salem, brought out bread and wine. He was of the priest of God and God of Most High. And he blessed him and said, blessed be Abram of God Most High, possessor of heaven and earth, and blessed be God Most High who has delivered your enemies into your hand. And he, Abraham, gave him a tenth of all. Now, what I want you to understand is that this is then used, and we're not going to spend the time doing it, but this is used by the Hebrew writer to talk about the connection between Jesus by the order of Melchizedek. This is in Hebrews chapter 11 and in verse 15 and 17. And you're familiar with that. And what is it about Jesus? Well, he's king and he's also high priest. And the Hebrew writer says, well, now, wait a minute. He can't be the priest because he's not of the tribe of Levi. And that's where he says, well, God changed things. God changed, and now we have a new law. And there had to be a change because, you're right, Jesus couldn't. But he's after the order of Melchizedek. Melchizedek was not only a king, but Melchizedek was also God's high priest. And that's a whole study in and of itself, but this is where that happens, where he is connected to the Messiah through that text. And then there's one other story, and that is where he makes intercession for Sodom. So as you know, God has a plan to destroy Sodom, and that's where Lot is living. But listen to the reason God decides to let Abram know about his plans. We're looking now at chapter, we're in 18, and we're looking at verse 17. The Lord said, shall I hide from Abraham what I'm doing? Since Abraham shall surely become a great and mighty nation, and all the nations of the earth shall be blessed in him. For I know him, in order that he may command his children and his household after him, that they keep the way of the Lord to do righteousness and justice, that the Lord may bring to Abraham what he has spoken to him. So what you have, of course, is God decides to let him know about his plans. And what we understand is because God had total confidence that Abraham would command his descendants to follow God, to do his will. And that is another indication to show, well, why was he a friend of God? Well, when God, he knew he would do what he needed to do. And that's very important for all of us. Because of his friendship with God, he's able then to have this petition before God. And there are times where you would be, you know, to think that you would say, in a sense, you say in your prayer as you did, this is the Creator. And you're going to bargain with him in a sense. But he does make intercession on behalf of Sodom. Again, what's he doing? He's thinking about other people. But he's also thinking about his, that's where Lot is. And that's where he's told that God is going to destroy the city. So this is where between 23 and 25, we start seeing this 50. Well, what if there's just five less and 45? What if there's only 40? What if there's only 30? What if there's only 20? What if there's only 10? People, would you destroy the city? And God kept saying, if there's 10 righteous, I won't destroy the city. He's concerned about the righteous people. And Lot and his family are there. But we're also told, and I do want you to turn over to 2 Peter chapter 2. I want you to see how Lot comes up in Peter's epistle. 2 Peter chapter 2, verse 7 and 8, and delivered righteous Lot, who was oppressed by the filthy conduct of the wicked, for that righteous man dwelling among them tormented his righteous soul from day to day by seeing and hearing their lawless deeds. You know, today we think, well, that's Christians trying to live in New York City or Los Angeles or maybe in Las Vegas and places like that. We think, you know, all of the sin, well, it can be right in our own small cities of Muscle Shoals. Aren't you vexed sometimes when you see the state of the country or maybe things going on in the community? Lot was pained. He was tormented. He was distressed. But as we know, 10 righteous people aren't found. And so Lot, however, is spared. Even though 10 can't be found, God does get Lot out of the city. He literally had to hurry him along. Look at chapter 19, verse 15 and 16. When the morning dawned, the angels urged Lot to hurry, saying, "Arise, take your wife and your two daughters who are here, lest you be consumed in the punishment of the city." And while he lingered, the men took hold of his hand, his wife's hand, and the hands of the two daughters, and the Lord being merciful to him, and they brought him out and set him outside the city. Boy, there's a study of Lot, isn't there? Lot just seems to get in all kinds of trouble all the time. Wrong place, gets taken, has to be rescued. Here he is once again. This idea of lingering is very, you know, telling too. It's kind of like, the city's going to be burned. Get the pictures. Make sure you grab that. Oh, we don't want to lose this. You can just see him lollygagging around and having to be brought out. Sadly, we know that Lot's wife doesn't even make it out of the city safely. As they're leaving, they're told, "Don't you look back," and she looks back. The instructions are very clear in verse 17 that they are not to look back. And yet in verse 26 it says, she looked back and she became a pillar of salt. Jesus would say, "Remember Lot's wife," when he's teaching on the importance of not turning back. And so there's so many things that are tied. Well, we began by noting that Abraham was called the friend of God. The most noteworthy demonstration of Abraham's faith is his willingness to be obedient even when asked to offer up his only son. Do you not see the faith was working together with his works? and by works faith was made perfect? His faith was known by his works, and that's because faith works. Hebrews 11, verse 10, for he waited for the city which has foundation, whose builder and maker is God. Jesus made it very clear that Abraham still lives. I am the father of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. And he made that point to the Sadducees. They're still living. So Abraham's still living. His spirit lives on. We see him on the Mount of that was Moses and Elijah. But we know that Abraham's spirit went back to God. And then we also have this last verse in Hebrews chapter 11, verse 19. Abraham knew God was more than capable of raising up his son, and he concluded that God was able to raise Isaac up even from the dead. So here's a man that had incredible faith when it came to trusting in God. Well, I hope that's been helpful in some small way. If you're here this afternoon and you need to obey the gospel of Jesus Christ, we're going to sing an invitation song and invite you to do that. If you are a child of God and you're not living right, and we can pray with you and for you, go to God and pray on your behalf. We'll be happy to do that. If there's something that is pressing and you need encouragement, then we'd be happy to pray with you about that as well. Craig has selected this invitation song, and we invite you to come as we all stand and sing.